Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 80 of Her, the podcast all about women, where we share the naked truth about her mind, her body, and her life. Today, we have an amazing story about a kidney doctor and her own journey, and this also includes a beautiful love story as well. So hang loose. But before we start the episode, I want to make sure you know that this episode is made possible by our friends at Smarty Pants Women's Complete Vitamins. They're delicious once-a-day gummies that contain the complete vitamin, mineral, folate, and omega mix customized for women. Trust me, you won't forget to take them because they taste so great. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And just a quick reminder to, hey, run on over to iTunes after our episode and rate and review us. I love to read these, and it helps me understand how to stay connected with you even better. So please, 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 iTunes. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Wow. This is going to be an amazing episode. It's all about a kidney doctor's journey, donating her own kidney to the man she loves. Dr. Vanessa Grubbs is the author of her first book, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match. Dr. Grubbs is an assistant professor of medicine and a nephrologist at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, where she maintains a practice and clinical research program. She received her undergraduate and medical degrees from Duke University and happily, you know I'm highly biased here because I'm a writer, teaches writing for patient advocacy to medical students and practicing physicians. She lives with her husband and teenage son in Oakland, California. Oh boy, Dr. Grubbs, welcome to the Her Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Gosh, I don't even know where to begin. You know, when I heard about your story, and I have your wonderful book in my hot little hands here, I was pretty blown away because there are so many layers to this. First of all, you know, I think most of our Her Podcast listeners want to know a little bit more about you. Why'd you go into medicine?
Well, you know, I think it was, I feel like a lot of my story is serendipity because I really didn't plan on most of what has happened. And when I was a high school junior, I was always a nerd. I was interested in math and science, and I knew I wanted to do something in the health field. But I'm from small town, North Carolina, and I never really saw any doctors that looked like me. And we rarely went to the doctor. So it wasn't something that was on my radar until my oldest brother, who is 16 years my senior, I'm the surprise baby of the family. He asked me, so what are you going to do after high school? And I had in my mind that I wanted to be a medical technologist. Not quite sure what that was, but it was different from everybody else in my high school, and it sounded good. And he says to me, well, you know, you should go all the way and be a doctor because you can. And that was actually the first time that I had that idea. And I said, okay, yeah, that's what I'll do. And so that was my first time landing on an ambition of being a physician.
Well, not just a physician, but also I believe that you were, when you went to Duke, you were one of only two women of color in your class. That mm-hmm. that had to be pretty profound for you.
Well, yeah, it was tough, but it wasn't really new. I mean, undergraduate school, even though there were many more people of color, it still is tough being part of a minority group. And often you feel like you don't belong, or people say things to suggest that you don't belong. And it takes a while, I think, to come to a place where you are strong enough to say, you know what, we're taking all the same tests to get to where we are. So I deserve to be here just as much as anybody else.
I love it. You know, when I went through, when dinosaurs ruled the earth, you know, you don't have to laugh so hard either.
oh.
You know, I mean, there were no women. There weren't any women. You know, so basically I was like, whatever, you know, quite frankly, I'm ACDC. I could go either way. So I'm like, you know, I can hang out with guys, I can hang out with women, but, this is obviously another level of being profound. Now, why nephrology?
Well, that actually came up because of my relationship with my husband. So, when we started dating, I was a primary care doctor and I knew that he was on dialysis. And as, when I was in training, I had taken care of patients who were on dialysis. But as you might imagine, a resident physician is mostly concerned about when am I going to get a chance to sleep. So really, I was just paying attention to the numbers, paying attention to the orders, and not really so much about the person living with the illness, which a large part of me is embarrassed to say, but that's the truth. And once I got involved with my husband, I was really up close and personal to what it is for a person to have kidney failure and to have a life on dialysis. And then because of him, too, I got a closer look at what the kidney transplant system is like. And I felt that it was a very uphill climb for him to get a deceased donor kidney. And I knew that a living donor kidney would be best for him in the long run. So that's why I decided to donate a kidney, just because of seeing what he goes through and seeing what the system is or was at that time. And so that was my solution for him. But for everyone else, I wanted to really transition my career to do research and access to kidney transplant, because as you may know, there is not equal access to kidney transplant. People of color tend to be much less likely to get transplant than white. And so and earlier when I said things were kind of serendipitous for me, I went to speak with a nephrologist, really just looking for a research project. And I told him a little bit of my backstory. And he said to me, you know, you should be a nephrologist for just one tough clinical year. It'll really change your perspective and how your work is perceived, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, well, okay. And so I applied to a nephrology fellowship, and that's how I got here.
Wow. And, you know, I think a lot of us out there are probably scratching our collective feminine head saying, what was it like to go through the thought process of becoming a kidney donor? I mean, whoa, this is not something you take lightly. Like, yeah, sure, let's, you know, donate the kidney. I mean, most people have only two kidneys. That's it. You obviously right. love this guy, but you'd only known him for what, 9 months? And now you're going to donate a kidney.
Well, actually, it was sooner because 9 months was from dating to surgery. So I actually made the decision probably at 6 months, somewhere in there. But, you know, it really was kind of a no-brainer for me. I felt like, okay, I have two. He needs one. So, hey, you know, I'll give him one. So, and I don't think I'm that different from donors in general. I think it is something that you just see, okay, this person needs this. I can help in this situation. So of course I do it. So for me, it wasn't really a struggle at all. I made up my mind in the moment when we were sitting in the exam room when he went for transplant evaluation, and I felt like the system was kind of stacked against him. And so in that moment, I said out loud to him, I think we should see if I can give you a kidney. And he said, no, I don't want to do that. And so because for him, the kind of pressure and guilt of taking something from me when he felt like, oh, well, if something goes wrong, and then I've left her in a worse place and all of that. But for me, it was worth the risk. And so I just didn't say anything else to him. I just went through the process of, okay, I need to get my evaluation. I need to get this CT scan. I need to collect my urine for a day, all these little steps that I had to do to show that I was healthy enough to donate. And it was just something that I went through, and I didn't question it. But as the country girl that I am, I did have signs that very much let me know that this was absolutely the right thing to do. And so I just never turned back.
Wow. I mean, it's, again, that's profound. It's like a big deal. I mean, dear God, I mean, you went through major surgery. They removed an organ. And, you know, you'd known this wonderful man for a relative short period of time. I know a lot of women out there are saying, oh, my gosh, you know, so many layers to this. But it sounds like you were pretty focused on, you know, getting this done. And once you'd made up your mind, you know, you had other things going on. What about other people in your life? Were they, you know, your family? You know, were they inputting at the same time about, you know, hey, think about this. What are you doing? What's going on? What was that backstory?
Yeah, I did get a lot of reaction from people. I started telling people as I was going through the process, and I don't know what I was expecting. I expected people to be generally supportive. And my parents were actually pretty supportive about it. I remember one colleague when I said, well, he needs two. And I mean, he needs one and I have two. So, of course, I do it. And she said to me, you know, Vanessa, it's not a pair of shoes. So, you know, just kind of expressing the kind of gravity of the whole thing. And another colleague said, well, you know, I do this in a heartbeat for my partner, but we've been married for 10 years, as if to say, you don't even have an engagement ring. So what, don't you want to like think this through a little bit? But I was really very much, you know, it didn't matter what anybody said to me at that point. I knew this is what I was going to do.
What was the timing on this in your marriage?
So our surgery was 4 months before the wedding. And one of the things that I do talk about in the book is how Robert, my husband, he was a young man when he started dialysis. He was diagnosed with kind of a genetically passed kidney disease when he was 16, and his kidneys failed completely when he was 26, and that's when he started dialysis. And you can imagine that a 26-year-old, that's when you feel like you're just starting life. You're just figuring out your path and your ambitions. But for him, kidney failure and dialysis definitely curbed his ambition and made him feel like it wasn't really safe to plan. So he kind of lived for the day because only today was promised. He had that kind of mindset. So once we had the surgery and we were past the, you know, the hospitalization, the first thing he started doing was planning our wedding. So it was
how interesting.
Yeah.
How very, very interesting the way the whole thing worked out. And then I would imagine watching him now open up his perspective about life in general must have been really gratifying to you now that he had that wonderful four-letter word that you and I as physicians love to be able to share, hope.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know. It's a tough one.
You know, just opening up his whole life, that must have made you feel really great to watch him change his perspective.
Oh, yeah.
It's one thing to live for the day, and that's great. All of us should be mindful and obviously embrace every single second because, you know, nothing's guaranteed. But in his case, starting from a very early age, there was no guarantee of anything.
Right. He really had to face his mortality at a very young age. And I think one of the greatest things like early on was when we were just in the post-op recovery space, we were not close enough to touch, but we were close enough to see each other. And I could see the Foley bag collecting urine, and it was just lots of yellow urine just flowing into his bag. And I was just so thrilled. It was a really wonderful just to see that bag full of pee. And then as we were in the next day in the hospitalization, he was so happy to be able to drink as much water as he wanted, because when he was on dialysis, if he drank much between his dialysis treatments, he definitely would pay for it.
Yeah, no question about it. And, you know, I think this is resonating with so many women out there who are caregivers of a partner or whomever out there, and, you know, how to really be able to stay sane and really do a good job taking care of someone else while you're also taking care of yourself. But, you know, there's a layer to this that I love, and that's the love story. In your book, you had a really lovely piece, and I'm going to read it. It said, recently I came across a box of keepsakes with a love letter that Robert wrote me, that wrote to me, and it was about more than a month after our surgeries, and you said, with a little help from Winston Churchill's letter to his darling Clementine, and it read, Vanessa, I know that neither one of us had in mind a year ago that we would meet someone and fall in love, but it has happened. And for that, I have no regrets. In fact, it is one of the best things that happened to me in years. For this and what has happened to us and between us, I have you to thank. For the past year, you have brought so much joy to me that words can never explain. In the past year, you have brought so much life back into a lifeless body. I know and realize what it is to love and to feel love. You have so enriched my life. I always feel so overwhelmingly in your debt, if there can be accounts in love. What it has been to me to live this time in your heart and companionship, no phrases can convey. Much, much love, Robert. Okay, I have one word. Wow. I mean, I think most of us as women are like, yeah, you know, where's my love letter like that? Damn, you know. You know, it's, tell me, you know, as a both a physician, talking to other people who are caregiving loved ones, and as a woman, how do you explain and how do you help people understand the depth of caregiving with a loved one?
Well, you know, most often what I see is that caregivers are giving so much and they forget about themselves. And I think doctors often forget to ask about the caregiver. I see often just with my patients who are facing kidney failure themselves, but yet they're doing so much for their families, maybe even being the breadwinner. And just to go through the conversation of saying, you know, you really have to take care of yourself or you're not going to be any good for anybody else. And I think that's really hard for women in particular, caregivers in general, to really understand, because that's what we do. We give and we take care of others because that's what they need. So I think it is really difficult for people to find that balance. And I think it's absolutely critical, though. Otherwise, you're going to burn out, your health, your own health will suffer. And then, you know, everybody will need somebody new to come in and take care of you all.
Yeah, it's a real tough one. So how's Robert's health today?
He's doing great. So we celebrated our 12th transplant anniversary, which he calls his rebirthday. That was in April.
Wow.
And so, of course, in August, we'll celebrate our 12th wedding anniversary. And he's, you know, working full time. He's finally got his career back to where he thought it should always be. And he's working his dream job now. And there's been no more dialysis since that hospitalization when we had surgery. So it's great.
Oh, my God. I so love it. So now we're going to put on the little doctor hat as we wind this up. And that doctor hat is, wow, the whole issue of caregiving someone who has kidney disease and then going to the transplant place. So what kind of words of wisdom based upon your own experience and, of course, your own expertise as a nephrologist?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's difficult for the patient because oftentimes these are people that have been fiercely independent, and to be in a position where they're starting to lose control of parts of their body and actually needing help is a very difficult thing. So it makes it truly difficult at best for them to ask for help. So I think for people involved like closely in their lives, sometimes it's good to just to offer, because people don't want to seem like a burden. So if people offer to help or do things, I think is tremendous. But also I wish more of my patients brought people with them to their appointments. Because, as you know, we can say some pretty heavy things to people, and, you know, you can see it in their eyes that they're kind of glossing over and not really hearing anything you say beyond, like, the first hard word. And so to have somebody else there to sit there and kind of take notes and also to ask the questions that the patient often forgets to ask, I think can be tremendously helpful.
Yeah. What are they most afraid of? What are patients really fearful of with this disease?
Well, everybody is afraid of dialysis. You know, as soon as they find out they have a kidney problem, most people have heard about or seen somebody close to themselves or either somebody that they know, and they always attribute the death to the dialysis, not any of the other medical problems they have or the kidney failure itself. So anyone who finds out they have kidney disease, even if they're nowhere close to dialysis, they all, like 99 out of 100, say to me, I'd rather die than ever be on dialysis. And truth be told, of that 99, 98 of them, when they get close to actually developing symptoms of kidney failure, which is very late in the course of the disease, then they say, oh, well, maybe I'll give that dialysis a try. So it is a very scary possibility, and I get that. And because people feel so well for so long, they tend not to believe us doctors when we tell them what is coming, and which is very frustrating because I feel like we could help people come to better terms with things and help prevent some of the more invasive things and the more scary parts of healthcare if people would, you know, have a little bit of trust in us and allow us to help them prepare. For example, if people would prepare for dialysis, then they wouldn't end up in the emergency room and getting in the hospital and getting unnecessary procedures because we can take care of things on an outpatient basis. So that's what I see people struggle with the most, just coming to terms with the diagnosis itself.
Interesting. You know, the other day, one of my patients asked me, because she's caregiving someone with kidney disease, who's not yet on dialysis, are stem cells going to be used in the near future to actually grow another organ? What do you think?
Well, they are working on it. I think they're at the point where they're trying to not test in humans yet. And the where they are in the process of developing the cells that do all that. I mean, the kidney is really amazing because there's all these specialized cells in it. And for them to even get to the point where they can mimic some of that is amazing. Things aren't lasting very long yet. I hear that the cells die within a couple weeks. And, you know, if you're going to get a surgery to have this artificial kidney put in, you really need it to last a lot longer than a couple weeks. So they've been going for years, but there are many years ahead. But I have also heard of, particularly at Stanford, I imagine other places too, but at Stanford they do a stem cell ablation so that the recipient doesn't need the immunosuppressant medications after transplant. One of my young patients decided to do that because as he knew and was very correct in thinking that if you've been on these immunosuppressant medications for many, many years, your risk of cancer is higher than the general population. So he wanted to take the chance of going through, even though it was quite a new procedure, to have the stem cell ablation and then get a transplant from his brother. And I think they were very closely matched genetically, not twins, but really close, so that it would work. And so he needed very little immunosuppressant after the surgery, and I think it's been managed without anything. And it's been several years now, at least 3-4 years, I want to say.
Oh, I think that is phenomenal. Talk about hopeful, you know, because yeah. The immunosuppressant, you know, therapy is just fraught with its own issues in a majorly way. Right. And I think a lot of people know that out there. So once again, there's some great advances here, and, you know, we can all be hopeful. I want to make sure everyone knows we have been talking to Dr. Vanessa Grubbs. She is an assistant professor of medicine and a nephrologist at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, where she maintains a practice and clinical research program. Here's the good news. She's the author of a book you gotta get, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match in More Ways Than One. It's a beautiful melding of medicine and love, because it's a love story too, because she donated her own kidney to the man she loves. Wow, what a great, great story. And run on over to her website, thenephrologist.com, to learn more about her wonderful work. Dr. Grubbs, thank you so much for being on the HERB podcast. This has been a tremendous episode for us.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. remember to catch every episode of Her, just hit subscribe on iTunes or on our show page at RadioMD.com. And please take 30 seconds and rate this podcast on iTunes. We love to hear from you, so please leave a review and a rate because I want to know what you're thinking out there. And I read these. I'm Dr. Pam Peek. Follow me on Twitter at PamPeekMD. And you can also check out our Her show page at RadioMD.com for all of our past episodes. Thanks for listening and stay well.